This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, February 5th, 2013. I'm Kyle Callum.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. KUAF is supported by Aurora Technologies, offering digital signage and menu boards for businesses and organizations of all sizes. Televisions or projectors can display your message, graphics, animated images, or videos at desired locations. More information is available at auroratechnologies.net.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Bishop Gene Robinson is coming to Fayetteville this weekend to be a speaker in the McMichael Lecture Series. Last week, he talked with Jacqueline Froelich, and we'll hear part of that conversation.
Plus, a new exhibit at one museum tells the story of another. The Shiloh Museum in Springdale is devoting space to the collection of the University of Arkansas Museum, a collection still intact even though it is no longer on permanent display to the public.
First, Arkansas tax revenues for January beat expectations, taking in 13.5% more than had been forecast. John Shelnut, an economist with the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration, says that's also 12% above this time last year.
We are up $83.4 million, or 2.9%. We will probably give some of that back as the income tax filing season progresses, but I would say we're on track to meet the fiscal year forecast, which assumes a $100 million addition to surplus funds.
Shelnut says the bulk of the increases were driven by a 10% jump in individual income tax collections, as some taxpayers sought to shift their income into tax year 2012 to avoid rate increases this year.
An Arkansas lawmaker is defending comments he made during a Tea Party rally last year at the state capitol. Republican Senator Jason Rapert says his comments, reported on by the publication The Nation, were selectively edited to make him appear racist. This is the segment that has been criticized.
I hear you loud and clear, Barack Obama. You don't represent the country that I grew up with. And your values is not going to save us. We're going to try to take this country back for the Lord. We're going to try to take this country back for conservatism. And we're not going to allow minorities to run roughshod over what you people believe in.
Rapert says he was referring to political minorities and not racial minorities. His comments have also been criticized for misrepresenting President Obama's appearances at the National Prayer Breakfast, saying he's never attended the event, when, in fact, the president has attended the event each year he's been in office.
The Arkansas House yesterday approved legislation that will allow churches to decide whether to allow concealed weapons. Some have raised concerns that allowing weapons could lead to insurance companies raising rates for churches that do allow weapons. But the bill sponsor, Republican Nate Bell of MENA, told his colleagues that hasn't happened elsewhere.
There's simply no logical reason to believe that insurance companies would single out Arkansas churches for such draconian policy changes when they have not done so in other states. Opponents of this bill have also argued that Senate Bill 71 would lead to visible handguns in places of worship and that this would be disruptive to worship. Our concealed carry law requires that the licensee keep his or her handgun entirely concealed and provides for revocation of their license if a firearm is carried visibly.
The bill, which passed in the Senate last week, was approved by the House by a vote of 85-8. Governor Mike Beebe has said he will sign it, but wants to work with lawmakers on the wording of the bill to address the concerns about liability.
There has been much talk about guns at the state capitol lately. A Senate bill that heads to the House Education Committee today would make sure schools know what to do in the event of an act of violence. District 30 Senator Linda Chesterfield of Little Rock introduced Senate Bill 93, and she says that it would mandate that the Legislative Council or the State Education Committee conduct a study. That study would assess schools' readiness to respond to acts of violence on their campuses.
What it would do is it would require or ask that each school district in the state create a readiness program in cases of, God forbid, school violence. It's a simple deal. It does what it says it's going to do. We need to know how many school districts are ready. Fort Smith is going through it right now. And other school districts, I hope, will be going through the same thing.
The reason Chesterfield proposed the study is that she is not in favor of a one-size-fits-all solution to address the problem of acts of violence at schools.
Each school will do it differently. Some will have in place guards at their school. Some will have in place metal detectors at their school. Some will have in place a signal that will say lock down all the rooms. It could be a number of things, but it would determine whether or not they're indeed looking at it, because I'm thinking that some school districts have not considered it. I would hope that it would be similar to what we would do in case of a tornado warning and make it become a part of the system's thought.
Senator Chesterfield's bill is one of a handful dealing with school violence or gun control that is on the House Education Committee's agenda for today. Two bills also on the agenda deal with allowing licensed and trained faculty and staff of state universities to carry concealed weapons on public college campuses.
For the second year in a row, the Northwest Arkansas area is ranked among the least expensive places to live in the country. The Council for Community and Economic Research has ranked the Fayetteville-Springdale-Rogers Metropolitan Statistical Area the sixth least expensive urban area in the nation in its cost of living index. The index measures regional differences in the cost of consumer goods and services, excluding taxes and non-consumer expenditures. Northwest Arkansas scored an 86 on the Council's cost of living index. That's 14% lower than the national average. Compare that to Manhattan in New York, the most expensive metro area to live in, with an index value of 225.
Sparks Health System in Fort Smith has been named one of 75 hospitals in the country selected to participate in a new initiative designed to reduce costs to the Medicare system. According to the City Wire, the hospital was selected by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to be a part of a bundled payments for care improvement program. Under the program, participating organizations will enter into payment arrangements that include financial and performance accountability for care related to a health episode as opposed to a visit-based payment structure. The model is expected to lead to higher quality and more coordinated care at a lower cost to Medicaid. Sparks is one of two healthcare facilities in the state participating in the bundled payments program, and it is the only facility in the northwestern portion of the state taking part in the program.
The University of Arkansas in Fayetteville will begin offering a doctorate in nursing practice beginning in the fall. According to the university, the degree will emphasize nursing practice and leadership rather than research. The doctorate program will use a hybrid delivery, requiring no more than 3 visits to campus, while courses will be delivered online. In addition, students in the program will be required to complete clinical hours under supervision. The program will offer 2 specialties, one a clinical nurse specialist track, the other an acute care nurse practitioner track. The program will be open to students with either a bachelor's or master's degree, but post-baccalaureate students will be required to take more hours than students who already have a master's degree.
Clear tonight with lows from 33 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 39 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, expect increasing clouds and a high of 63 in northwest Arkansas, mostly sunny with a high near 66 in the Arkansas River Valley. And tomorrow night, there is a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms with lows from 43 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 47 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. Several committees at the state capitol are expected to deal with important and controversial matters this winter. The House Public Health Committee may have the most to consider by the end of the session. Last week was an indication of how contentious some of these discussions might become. An early release of an audit of the state's Medicaid system has been delayed, creating sniping across partisan aisles. And several bills dealing with reproductive rights and abortion are also headed toward debate. And there is the big discussion looming in regard to the possible expansion of Medicaid.
Late last week, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business talked to Representative John Burris, a Republican from Harrison, and the chairman of the House Public Health Committee. Roby asked him about these matters and others.
You've got a lot of pro-life, anti-abortion bills. You've got just a variety of things that deal with reproductive rights.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to handle that coming into your committee? It's volatile stuff. It's definitely got a lot of passion on both sides of that issue.
How I'll handle it's pretty simple, especially as committee chair. You're really just there to really more as the overused analogy of being an umpire and calling the balls and strikes. We already had one bill come through that was controversial, Representative Wilkins, House Bill 1100. Similar to that, we need to have debate. We need to have everybody express their views on the issue, especially on an issue like that, though. I think it's something where most people kind of know how they feel, and that's a good thing. That's not to minimize the debate. It's actually to highlight the fact that it's such an important debate. It's very well defined most times. You get into some of these technical debates on on language and legislation. But for the most part, people know how they feel about abortion. And so we'll have a good debate. We'll have a lot of discussion. I think a lot of these bills are going to be vetted previously, having been filed before, maybe coming over from the Senate. So,
do you have some concerns because the objections that have been raised to some of them is that it will violate aspects of the Constitution, previous court precedent. Does that not concern you that you're going to potentially go down that road and have to deal with the state cost in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, legitimate threats of litigation concern me, but to be honest, I've never heard a bill filed that was controversial that wasn't threatened to get us into litigation. So I think it's a little bit of an overused threat. I'll examine things on their own merits and make a determination whether or not I think it would actually put us at risk for litigation. I don't know that any of the bills that have been filed actually do that. I think it's a threat that people use but rarely plays out.
Do you think that this is the best use of the legislature's time to debate these types of bills that are so controversial and divisive and deal with these passionate social issues? You're really down here to pass a budget and keep the function of state government going. This is a law that impacts people's lives, their bodies, and the unborn.
Yeah, I mean, if we're not talking about the controversial stuff, what are we going to be talking about? The less important stuff. So, I mean, I think it's absolutely the role of the legislature, especially the Public Health Committee. You've got 100 people in the House, 35 in the Senate, all have different passions and different views. I've been a guy that's really probably been more focused on the budget during my short time here, budget and taxes, and so that's a passion of mine, but you've got to wear many hats down here, and I think the social issues are still a pretty key component of that. While all the other discussions are taking place, I don't think they take away from each other at all. We still have to pass a budget. We're still going to talk about tax reform, but we need to address some of these issues too because they're important to the people of Arkansas.
Let's talk about where some things go with the budget. Obviously, Medicaid is going to be the linchpin to kind of unravel the budget and mm-hmm. give you guys the biggest piece of the jigsaw puzzle to put into place. I sense particularly from the Audit Executive Committee meeting this afternoon, that everybody's just going to kind of sit and wait to see what comes out of this audit report. First of all, have you seen the audit report that's been discussed?
No, haven't seen it.
What do you think it addresses?
Based on the executive committee meeting that you and I just attended, it seems like it is some previous audit findings, but then also this current year single audit findings that was due to be released in March, but they're going to just release in a special report early because of how it relates to our current debate about Medicaid. And I think that's the right decision, and we'll see what the audit says. But it seems like some of what's in there is going to be relevant to the discussion that we're having about Medicaid and whether or not we're spending our dollars in the most efficient way.
If it's been out in 2009, 2010, 2011, which will be incorporated into these findings, mm-hmm. that's already been reported. It's already been out there for you guys to review. What could possibly be different?
I don't know. And that's why I think it'd be good for the public to see the audit. And it may be nothing. But regardless of all of that, I think it's been the longstanding position of many of us in the House and Senate that we have a very expensive and out-of-control Medicaid system as it is. You know, it was projected earlier in the year that we were going to face a $400 million deficit in funding. We've got over 750,000 people, population of Arkansas, on the system now. And, in regards to expansion, I just think a lot of us have felt it's smarter to slow down and make sure we're doing what we're currently doing. And I think if this audit shows us some ways that we can improve our systems and the dollars we're already spending, then we need to do that. And I think that's going to be the key part of the discussion moving forward.
Do you think you have the information that you need to make some of the Medicaid decisions in terms of closing the gap? Do you think you know where the money's going to come from to do that in terms of whether or not to decide on expansion one way or the other? Do you think you have the information you need to do that?
That's a good question. And I think we have some information, but a lot of the target keeps moving. I mean, the gap's been shrinking every day. I don't know necessarily why, but I think we're probably going to see that the funding shortfall be even smaller as we move forward through this debate. And so, we're moving away from that $400 million number. Grandma's going to get to stay in the nursing home. Elliot, she was always going to get to, at least now we're all admitting it. And we're going to see, I think, as the session progresses, a more reasonable number. And the good news is we have plenty of ways to address it, be it general revenue and growth and collections or one-time money through an accumulated surplus, which using one-time money to to bridge our Medicaid deficit is something that has been done several times in the past, including the immediate past 4 or 5 years, be it through stimulus funding or from completely depleting the trust fund that had accumulated a balance of over $400 million. So using one-time money is an accepted practice in the Capitol. What we're going to do is make sure that we fully fund what needs to be funded, only to bridge a gap to actually reforming the system and putting us on a path to long-term stability where we don't need to dip into trust funds or stimulus funds or GIF funds to make this happen. So the money's there, we're gonna fund the program, but we're gonna do it in a responsible way, and only after we're convinced that we've done what we need to do to put the system on the path to the long-term solvency.
What do you think are some of the things that need to be done to put the system on a path to long-term solvency?
Yeah, and I think that's the debate that we're going to start having soon. Like it or not, the first few weeks of the session have been completely dominated by expansion, it seems like. And I think we're going to finally at least hit pause on that for a little bit and kind of move into, over the next few weeks, what can we do different? And I think there's going to be a lot of proposals. Really, there's going to be no shortage of proposals on how we can tweak the system.
Do you have some ideas on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're going to get into a lot of that in the next couple of weeks. And a lot of members, I think you're going to see members who haven't really even been involved with the debate coming forward with ideas on how we can do things better and different. So I think that's coming.
Give me one thing. You're dodging my question on this.
No.
Give me one example of something you're going to do, want to see proposed to make it differently.
It's fair enough. I mean, right now we don't do any income verification or any means testing for a lot of our programs, including some of the ones with the highest enrollment. The thresholds for enrollment are already very high for a lot of the programs, but we don't cross-reference or check at all to make sure that what people are saying when they're applying for programs, what they're putting on those applications is accurate. I think before you even start talking about anything else, simply talking about verifying that the people that are on the system are supposed to be on the system is a good place to start.
All right. Last question for you. On the subject of expansion, philosophically, where do you stand on expansion? Opposed to it? In favor of it? In favor of finding some sort of compromise?
Yeah, I mean, I think philosophically where I stand is that the fact that we could even be talking about having over a third of our population qualify for government assistance and really completely funding government health care because they're so poor ought to be the thing we're talking about. And so I want to make sure that we do things to make sure that 10 years from now, 35% of our Kansans aren't in that federal poverty level range where they're having to rely on government for their living. That's the opposite of everything we should be. And so philosophically, I guess I start out from being just almost embarrassed that we're there and wanting to do some things to change it. But then I come back to after we do some things to put our state on a path to prosperity that helps all our Kansans, raise our median incomes, make insurance more affordable. You know, how do we make sure that the 750,000 people that are covered now in Medicaid are getting the best services in the state, spending the dollars wisely? So it's just, you know, I don't want to dodge another one, but it's just philosophically, it's a very tough pill to swallow how we're even here.
Ruby Brock from our content partner Talk Business talked with Representative John Burris, a Republican from Harrison, late last week. You can see and hear more from that interview at talkbusiness.net. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Texas, Arkansas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at aecc.com.
The Oscar-nominated film Zero Dark Thirty opens with a declaration that the story is based on firsthand accounts of actual events. But lawmakers like Senator Dianne Feinstein take issue with the film's depictions of torture and want the film branded as fiction. I'm Celeste Headlee. The shifting opinions on what's torture and what's not. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville is hosting Bishop Gene Robinson as the keynote speaker for its annual McMichael Lecture Series this coming weekend. Bishop Robinson is the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church, elected in 2003. He took an early retirement from that post late last year and is now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with Bishop Robinson by phone last week and brings us his story.
Vicki Jean Robinson was born 1947 into poverty in rural Kentucky to Imogene and Victor, tobacco sharecroppers. Their firstborn infant son, who survived a traumatic birth event, was soon baptized in the Disciples of Christ faith. The intensely religious little boy vowed to follow Jesus Christ as his personal Lord and Savior. But Vicki Jean grew up knowing he was somehow different. In college, he sought to be cured from his attraction to men by undergoing therapy and serving God. He graduated from the University of the South in 1969 with a BA in American Studies and History. In 1973, he completed his Master's of Divinity degree at the General Theological Seminary in New York, and was ordained deacon and then priest, serving as curate at Christ Church, Ridgewood, New Jersey.
What drew me to the Episcopal Church was the sense of history, this connection through the apostolic succession all the way back to the disciples themselves. And also, I loved the liturgy. The disciples claim not to be a liturgical church, but you find out how liturgical it is if you try to change anything in the Sunday morning service. So it's not a matter of being liturgical or not liturgical. It's a matter of recognizing that you have a liturgy. And I found the language and the drama of the Episcopal liturgy to be very compelling. I loved that you had to get out of your seat and go to the altar rail to receive communion. And I loved the beauty and pageantry of it. So in some ways, it felt like a completion of my faith and practice in the Disciples' Church.
While in seminary, Robinson met and dated Isabella McDaniel. They married in 1972. But he made his spouse aware of his orientation from the very beginning. After 14 years of marriage, the couple sought an amicable divorce. They continued to co-parent their two daughters, who are now grown. In the autumn of 1987, Robinson met Mark Andrew, a Peace Corps recruiter. They were joined in a civil union a decade later. After serving as longtime assistant to the Bishop of New Hampshire, Gene Robinson was elected bishop of that diocese in the summer of 2003, the first gay man in the history of the Episcopal Church to be consecrated as such. The event triggered a schism between liberal and conservative factions of the Greater Anglican Communion, as it's called, which persists to this day. Finally, Bishop Gene Robinson and Mark Andrew were married in January of 2010 under New Hampshire's newly enacted marriage equality law. But their lives have been fraught with constant death threats. Several weeks ago on NPR's Fresh Air, Bishop Robinson told Terry Gross that after he prayed the invocation at President Barack Obama's inauguration in 2009, police arrested a deranged motorist 2 weeks later, finding evidence that he was on his way to assassinate the bishop and his husband. Living under siege, he said, has become a way of life.
I think, at least currently, there is such a price to be paid for being an out gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender person that you'd have to have your head examined to choose it. And I think it argues for this being something that we can't change, not with prayer, not with wishing for it, not with hard work. I did all of those things. I was in therapy twice a week for 2 years. No one could have prayed harder than I did to be relieved of what I saw as a morally fatal flaw. And the answer I ultimately got from God was, I love you just the way you are, and there is nothing for you to be ashamed of, and there's nothing for you to change. I think it's the experience of most LGBT people that the price to be paid for living a life of integrity and claiming who you are is so great that no one would do it unless they felt compelled to do it, either by their life experience or even by their faith. The fact of the matter is, I felt called by God to come out. Every week, I'm called upon to climb into a pulpit and exhort people to live a life of integrity. And unless you're living a life of integrity yourself, you can't do that very well. And so it felt like a call from God to me to come out.
Bishop Gene Robinson's written extensively about his personal experience, most recently in God Believes in Love, Straight Talk About Gay Marriage, published by Knopf. In the book, he makes the case that Jesus does not condemn those who are different.
We all have to be careful about putting words in Jesus' mouth. But from everything that is recorded about what he said and did, it seems pretty clear that he was concerned about and an advocate for those who were marginalized, either by the society of his day or the religious establishment of his day. And he got into terrible trouble for that, associating himself with prostitutes and tax collectors and lepers and all sorts of societal misfits. And so I think it is not a stretch to say that Jesus, if he were alive today in this culture, would see the plight of gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people as one worthy of his attention and his advocacy.
The Holy Scriptures are the Word of God, Bishop Robinson says, but not the words of God. They were written by men of a certain era and culture. That context must always be taken into consideration, especially when the Bible is used to denigrate.
Sometimes when speaking with biblical literalists, I get the impression that they believe that God said everything God had to say to humankind by the end of the first century when the canon of Scripture was closed. That is to say, when we decided what books would go in what we now call the Bible. But I believe that we worship a living God, not one locked up and confined to that text, as sacred and holy as it is. I believe in a living God that continues to reveal God's self to us over time and as we can manage to hear it. Look at how many centuries we used Scripture to justify slavery. Religious people used Scripture to justify slavery, and now we would be horrified at such a thought. There are many denominations that still use Scripture to justify the denigration and subjugation of women based on Scripture. And now we're asking the big question, could we possibly have gotten it wrong about gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people the way we got it wrong about slavery and about women? And I think the answer to that is yes.
Bishop Robinson writes that GLBT couples continue to languish in a society that denies them basic civil rights. So he took an early retirement from his post as Bishop of New Hampshire in late 2012 at the age of 65 and accepted a position as senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, based in Washington, D.C.
A liberal think tank begun by John Podesta in 2003. John was the chief of staff for President Clinton and managed the transition team for President Obama. I'm a firm believer that there is a rightful role for religion to play in the shaping of public policy, but not quite in the way that the religious right has done it. And so I want to use this next part of my life to see if I can bring a moral perspective to the issues that face us as a nation. And so I will be working on, of course, gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender issues, but also immigration reform, healthcare reform, poverty, the growing rift between rich and poor. You know, the Bible speaks more about the poor and vulnerable and our treatment of them than almost any other moral issue. And society seems to only focus on sex, but the Bible focuses on money and possessions and poverty and the care of widows and orphans and the other vulnerable. And in both the Hebrew scriptures of the Old Testament and the Christian scriptures of the New, we hear that we will be judged by how we care for the most vulnerable in our midst.
But Bishop Gene Robinson will always have to reckon with being an internationally recognized historic religious figure.
You know, the election of me as the Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire in 2003 was such a jolt. You know, the day before the election, I was just Gene Robinson, and the day after, my picture was on the front page of every newspaper in the world. There was a sort of no ramp-up time for me to get used to being so in the public eye. I certainly resisted the label gay bishop for a very long time. And then after a couple of years, I realized that I had been given this remarkable opportunity and that it would be selfish of me not to take advantage of this opportunity that had come my way. And so I decided that I would stop worrying about being labeled the gay bishop and try to be the best steward I could be of that opportunity. But I must say, after nearly 10 years of that, it still feels surreal. Because, you know, when you're a public figure, you're sort of a walking Rorschach onto which people project bad and good things. And I am neither the angel or the hero that my admirers think I am, nor am I the devil that my detractors think I am. And I think the trick to being famous without believing your own PR is to hold on to who you actually are, as opposed to those images that people project onto you. And it helps to have a husband who says from time to time, I don't care if you are the bishop, the trash needs to go out, so get on it. He keeps me humble, and my children and my grandchildren keep me humble. And yet it's been an extraordinary honor to play this, I suppose you would call it, historic role.
Bishop Gene Robinson will speak at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville this Saturday evening at 7 p.m., as well as Sunday morning at 10 a.m. His keynote is titled, Being a Prophet in a Time of High Anxiety. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more about Bishop Gene Robinson's visit to Northwest Arkansas, you can go to the McMichael Series page on St. Paul's website. You can also call 442-7373.
The Elma Performing Arts Center presents In the Mood on Tuesday, February 12th at 7:30 p.m. This retro 1940 musical review features singers and dancers with the String of Pearls Big Band Orchestra. Tickets and more information are available at elmapac.org or 632-2129.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
There is a new exhibit at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art.
Yes, some new pieces on loan from regional museums, including the Eureka the Eureka Historical Museum, the Cherokee Heritage Center in Tahlequah, the Clinton Library in Little Rock, and the Daisy Airgun Museum in Rogers.
Yes, this exhibit is up through January of next year, and it follows a similar exhibit that had items on loan from places like the Pea Ridge National Military Park, the Rogers Historical Museum, the University Museum at the U of A, and the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale.
They had the little, like, it was like built into the wall and
right.
had the glass there that you could see the little pieces. It was like artifacts from the area.
That kind of tell the
history
area.
Of the Ozarks, kind of.
Yeah, so it's a partnership between Crystal Bridges Museum and other area museums.
Right.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the Shiloh Museum, which was in that first one, a new exhibit there is made up of artifacts from the University Museum.
Very excited about this
yes.
one. The permanent open to the public home of the museum closed several years ago, but as Ozarks at-largest John Schleiss reports, the collection remains intact.
It's not often that one local museum showcases the collection of another museum, but that's happening this week as the Fayetteville meteorite, a black bear, and glowing minerals go on display at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale. The items come from the University of Arkansas Museum Collections, which had an exhibit hall in the Fieldhouse on Garland Avenue until 2003. Curator of Collections Mary Suter says the museum's exhibit hall, administrative offices, and education department were all closed down for budgetary reasons. Suter now manages a vast collection of artifacts covering several studies.
Obviously, we have a very large archaeological collection. We have the largest collection of artifacts collected from Arkansas. We have a costume collection. Like, we have lots of UA band jackets through time. We have an ethnographic collection that centers on Africa and Mexican masks and a lot of historic Native American pieces. We have a geology collection that includes rocks, minerals. We have a history collection that has a very large pressed glass component. And then, of course, we have the zoology collection, which is skins, skulls, and some hole mounts, and then fluid specimens.
Suter says that the collection has 7.5 million artifacts in all. She says, however, that a lot of those artifacts are very small, like projectile points or bunches of small fish and bluff shelter seeds. Suter says the University Museum started in the geology department in the late 1800s as a sort of way to collect different minerals to show students. At the time, there was a growing search for the mineral wealth of Arkansas. That collection then morphed into a cabinet of curiosities, accepting other artifacts, like Native American pottery and cultural relics. Suter says the museum's first director, Sam Dillinger, felt that artifacts found in Arkansas should remain in Arkansas, so he organized the formal museum and began building up other segments like zoology and history. This year is the 140th anniversary of that original geology collection, according to records, and today the collection remains intact and continues to grow, even though much of it rarely gets out in front of the public. Besides a small exhibit space on the fifth floor of Old Main, some objects go out on loan to other museums. Suter says it's nice to have a variety of the different types of objects in the collection on display locally at the Shiloh Museum. The director of the Shiloh Museum, Alan Lord, says she has two main goals for this exhibit, which opens this week.
The exhibit is really about two things. One is a little bit about the history of the museum, which started more or less in 1873. And therefore was marking the 140th year this year. And it will talk a little bit about how it went from different professors collecting things to use in their classes to becoming more of both a research collection and a show exhibit collection. So we'll talk about that history. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I really want to emphasize is, since the museum as a public space closed in 2003, the collections that are now 140 years old or less are still around. They still exist, and they're still used both for research within the university and outside the university, and by museums like myself and others that borrow things for exhibit and other purposes.
Lord worked at the University Museum as the registrar back when the exhibit space was still open, so she's familiar with a lot of the objects. She says she's trying to recreate some of the exhibits from the old museum.
Figuring out what to show was very difficult, so I hope I've given a good cross-section of that, of what's there. And I think, especially for those who remember going to the University Museum over the years, whether it was in Old Main, Hotz Hall, or in the old field house, there'll be some things that I hope they'll say, I remember that. In fact, we have three really little collections that kind of duplicate, in small sense, an exhibit that was in the museum at one time.
One of those is a glass case of minerals, simple-looking rocks, some about the size of a bicycle helmet. But under a black light, the minerals begin to glow. They shine a deep purple and gold, while others shine turquoise green. The exhibit also features several study skins of different animal specimens. For Lord, one really stands out.
One of my favorite items in this whole exhibit is in the study skin section, and it was something that came in after I worked there, so I'd never seen it. And it's called a green spider monkey. It's relatively small, so when it, and it's laid out in what we've called the speed racer position, with arms fully out in front and legs fully out, so it's somewhat flat, of course. There's no skeleton in it, but it's slightly green. It has a little widow's peak like Eddie Munster, and it's just an amazing, amazing specimen. It's one of my favorites.
Some of the other animals on display are suspended in alcohol in large glass jars. There's a large frog, snakes, and minnows, of which he's actually taking guesses on the total, kind of like jelly beans in a jar. Lord says some visitors may not be particularly fond of the suspended animals, but there are several other objects of curiosity. A large organ-like piece sits in a corner. Lord says this piece will be popular for anyone with a connection to the University of Arkansas.
We actually have the early furniture piece, which is a keyboard and a timer that were in Old Main and was the carillon, the chiming and the music that came out of the towers of Old Main to mark the changing of classes and the hours. So this, before it became highly technical, this keyboard and its electric system and timer was what people heard coming off of Old Main. So it's a quintessential University of Arkansas piece of equipment.
There's also a section pulled from the old museum's discovery room, a room specifically designed for children to learn about science by interacting with the objects. The museum's curator of zoology, Nancy McCartney, helped organize it in the 1990s.
This was really the idea of Johnny Gentry, who was the director then, and Bob Winkleman, who was the exhibit specialist. And at that time, we were in what we call it, the old men's gym. And downstairs was this great big old room that people had used for dance classes for years and years back in the day when it was the gym. And so they decided that they would turn this into a room for kids, which is what many museums have, because it's important to get little children who have a lot of curiosity and a lot of energy interested in things. There is a magic of things. To see a real object is fascinating. You can see a picture in a book, but to see the real thing is astounding.
Alan Lord at the Shallow Museum expands on this by saying that museums provide a diverse way of learning. It's not just about sitting there and being lectured at. It's about interactivity with the objects and the people around you. She says it's also about contributing to the curation of an exhibit. She says she remains hopeful that one day the university will reopen the University Museum.
To me, it's a matter of commitment and certainly a matter of money. But I don't think the University of Arkansas has ever backed away from a challenge when it was put forward. And there certainly would be a challenge to bring something back, but the elements are there. I would love to see a university museum again. I think I was once told by someone in Florida, which has some very great museums and a great university museum, that I think the phrase he used was, every great university has a great museum. And if you think of the Harvard, of course, and Yale, and some of the better institutions, Florida being one of them, have great museums. I would say the same thing and have said about a county or a city or a state. And certainly I'd like to say that Springdale is a great city and it has a great museum. I think the same could be said of Rogers. And so I'd like that to be said about the University of Arkansas.
Well, until the university reopens the museum, you can see a selection of the objects at the Shallow Museum beginning this week. The Shallow Museum is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Admission is free. For more information about the Shallow Museum or the University of Arkansas Museum Collection, visit our website, kuaf.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm John Schlois.
This is Ozarks at Large. Macbeth, presented by the University of Arkansas Drama Department, will be presented for four nights beginning tomorrow night in Kimple Room 404. Each night, Macbeth will begin at 8. And the best news, this performance, absolutely free.
I love free.
I do too.
I love free. Not entirely free, but the Roots Festival, we've mentioned that, that a couple of the bands have been announced. I'm looking forward to that in August. Last year, one of the highlights was Pokey LaFarge.
Yes.
Pokey and his band, they're coming back to the region next month. Yesterday, the OK Mozart Festival announced that Pokey LaFarge and the South City 3 will play St. Patrick's Day at the Hilton Garden Inn in Bartlesville. The concert benefits the OK Mozart Festival, and you can learn more at okmozart.com.
Good news for the University of Arkansas swimming and diving team. This weekend, they finished the dual meet part of the season. Now comes the SEC championships. They finished the dual meet, which you might call the regular part of the season, with the program's best ever record, 10-1.
Wow, that's great.
Arkansas is ranked 18th in the country. They will next hit the pool February 19th for the SEC Conference Championships taking place in College Station, Texas.
I got to do a story on them last year, and I went to one of their practices. I am a terrible swimmer, so it's so impressive to see people where it's like, so easy for them.
I mean, there you go.
Yes. It's, I mean, it's a lot of work, and they put in a lot of work, but they make it look effortless.
Yes.
Ridiculous.
Yes.
Last note here for you guys. There is a blood drive tomorrow at ATU Ozark campus in Ozark. It takes place from 8:30 to 3:30 in the Student Services Conference Center. Each donor will receive a t-shirt, health screening, and more. Walk-ins are welcome, but you can also set up an appointment. And for more information, visit arkbi.org.
That's the blood drive in Ozark.
Yes.
There's also one on the University of Arkansas campus that started yesterday and goes through Saturday, Monday through Friday from 11:30 until 5:30 at the HL Embry Room at the Willard Walker Hall.
This week in This American Life, when the new girl showed up at high school, Justin fell hard.
Oh man, you know, she was mature in the body-wise because she was older than what she was saying.
Yeah, much older. Because Justin's new crush was an undercover cop. Which Justin didn't know when he asked her to the prom. Love strokes people and what they do for love this week.
This American Life, Saturday morning at 6 and Sunday morning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
One of the most critically approved albums of last year was Take the Kids Off Broadway by the duo Foxygen. Our music guide, Katie Henriksen, offers her own opinions.
The 22-year-old duo of Sam France and Jonathan Ratto, known as the band Foxygen, are a polarizing force. Whereas Pitchfork has given their sophomore release, We Are the 21st Century Ambassadors of Peace and Magic, the title of Best New Music, others dismissed this decidedly retro-influenced act as purely retromaniacs, as did Tom Hocking on FlavorWire. He says they've taken the time-honored route to commercial success, mining the contents of their parents' record collections and doing their best to reproduce the contents thereof pretty much verbatim. France and Ratto have been playfully making music together as Foxygen, a name that stuck when a friend coined it in high school, since age 15, and there's a youthful enthusiasm here combined with a synergy that only comes when you've had the opportunity to collaborate for years. It's a simple formula that works, because France and Ratto update their parents' record collections from the 60s and 70s with a purely millennial take. There's no way these lyrics or exact mix of beats, playful keys, and guitar could have been made in 1969. And for someone like me who's drawn to drones, twang, and all things down-tempo, Foxygen provides an injection of upbeat enthusiasm, and couldn't we all use a little of that as the winter blues set deep here in February? Melody is easy to hum. France singing off-the-cuff phrases such as, I'm talking to my grandma who lost her arms in the war, the aliens in armory that bombed her cigar store, as in No Destruction, and moments of jangly synth-infused ecstasy in standouts like Blue Mountain. I was climbing up Blue Mountain. Yes, their video for San Francisco is decidedly twee, with scenes of dancing in the woods, playing music on a bed, and France flipping through pictures on a viewfinder as he sits on an antique couch. Even the label's press release describes the music as the raw D. West anonymization of the Rolling Stones, Kinks, Velvet's Bowie, etc., that a whole mess of young people desperately need. So they're inviting the Wes Anderson critics right away. It's a fine line between cloyingly retro-infused artful cuteness and pure affect, but Foxygen balances it well enough for me. Playful, thoughtful, tinged with bittersweet, We Are the 21st Century Ambassadors of Peace and Love is a solid album of catchy hooks, dance beats, and youthful rock and roll that provide a refreshing antidote to this listener's usual draw of the more doom and gloom inflicted. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
The album is called Take the Kids Off Broadway. The duo is Foxygen. Katie Henriksen provided our review.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Shiloh.
And you're not talking about Shiloh,
no.
The pre-Springdale town of Shiloh.
No, it's located north of Russellville. I did not know this.
I didn't either. I don't think I've ever been there.
Well, there you go.
All right.
Fun fact.
You and I are back tomorrow.
We are.
For another edition of Ozarks Large. Did you watch the Super Bowl?
I did. Went to a party, in fact. I watched the Super Bowl / I watched the commercials.
Yes.
I enjoyed the commercials.
Did you have a favorite?
I don't know if I had a favorite. I was busy, like, talking and just doing things, so sure. I know I didn't catch everything. So I plan to sit down and watch some that I missed maybe online. I really, early on, there was one for a car, and of course I can't remember the car.
They only spent $4 million for that half minute. Why should you remember who it was?
We won't tell them that. I enjoyed it. It was this kid was going to prom, and he was going to have to go by himself. And so to kind of make it better, his dad says he can take the car, and it's the shiny new expensive car, and it gives the kid all this confidence to go, you know, into prom kind mm-hmm. of with lots of confidence. Goes in and kisses the girl, but of course the girl is the prom queen and she has a guy, and so the final
and he comes with a shiner
but a smile on
yes.
his face.
I saw the end of that one. I wasn't paying attention.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what was going on.
I thought it was a good one,
but we don't know who it was.
What about you?
I like the one with Samsung with Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen, but I didn't watch
it. It got a little long,
yeah,
that one.
I have to admit, when the game wasn't on, I really wasn't watching.
Yeah.
That's not what people want to hear when they pay
$4 million. Sorry, guys.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We're back tomorrow with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Noon.
Have a good day.